I hope you can get a sense of how incredible this realization is. There appears to be a large philosophical gulf between a collection of cells and our conscious experience, yet mind and brain are one and the same. In calling this a hypothesis, Crick was being politically correct. That the cells in our brains create the mind is a fact, not a hypothesis. We need to understand what these 30 billion cells do and how they do it. Fortunately, the cortex is not just an amorphous blob of cells. We can take a deeper look at its structure for ideas about how it gives rise to the human mind. Let's go back to our dissection table and look at the brain some more. To the naked eye, the neocortex presents almost no landmarks. There are a few, to be sure, such as the giant fissure separating the two cerebral hemispheres and the prominent sulcus that divides the back and front regions. But just about everywhere you look, from left to right, from back to front, the convoluted surface looks pretty much the same. There are no visible boundary lines or color codes demarcating areas that specialize in different sensory information or different types of thought. People have long known there are boundaries in there somewhere, though. Even before neuroscientists were able to discern anything helpful about the circuitry of the cortex, they knew that some mental functions were localized to certain regions of it. If a stroke knocks out Joe's right parietal lobe, he can lose his ability to perceive or even conceive of anything on the left side of his body or in the left half of space around himself. A stroke in the left frontal region, known as Broca's area, by contrast, compromises his ability to use the rules of grammar. Although his vocabulary and his ability to understand the meanings of words are unchanged. A stroke in an area called the fusiform gyrus can knock out the ability to recognize faces. Joe can't recognize his mother, his children, or even his own face in a photograph. Deeply fascinating disorders like these gave early neuroscientists the notion that the cortex consists of many functional regions or functional areas. The terms are equivalent. We have learned a lot about functional areas in the past century, but much remains to be discovered. Each of these regions is semi-independent and seems to be specialized for certain aspects of perception or thought. Physically, they are arranged in an irregular patchwork quilt, which varies only a little from person to person. Rarely are the functions cleanly delineated. Functionally, they are arranged in a branching hierarchy. The notion of a hierarchy is critical, so I want to take a moment to carefully define it. I'll be referring to it throughout the book. In a hierarchical system, some elements are, in an abstract sense, above and below others. In a business hierarchy, for example, a mid-level manager is above a mail clerk and below the vice president. This has nothing to do with physical aboveness or belowness. Even if she works on a lower floor than the mail clerk, the manager is still above him hierarchically. I emphasize this point to make clear what I mean whenever I talk about one functional region being higher or lower than another. It has nothing to do with their physical arrangement in the brain. All the functional areas of the cortex reside in the same convoluted cortical sheet. What makes one region higher or lower than another is how they are connected to one another. In the cortex, lower areas feed information up to higher areas by way of a certain neural pattern of connectivity, while higher areas send feedback down to lower areas using a different connection pattern. There are also lateral connections between areas that are in separate branches of the hierarchy, like one mid-level manager communicating with her counterpart in a sister office in another state. A detailed map of the monkey cortex has been worked out by two scientists, Daniel Fellman and David Van Essen. The map shows dozens of regions connected together in a complex hierarchy. We can assume the human cortex has a similar hierarchy. The lowest of the functional regions, the primary sensory areas, are where sensory information first arrives in the cortex. These regions process the information at its rawest, most basic level. For example, visual information enters the cortex through the primary visual area called V1 for short. V1 is concerned with low-level visual features such as tiny edge segments, small-scale components of motion, binocular disparity for stereo vision, and basic color and contrast information. V1 feeds information up to other areas, such as V2, V4, and IT. We'll have more to say about them later, and to a bunch of other areas besides. Each of these areas is concerned with more specialized or abstract aspects of the information. For example, cells in V4 respond to objects of medium complexity, such as star shapes in different colors like red or blue. Another area, called MT, specializes in the motions of objects. In the higher echelons of the visual cortex are areas that represent your visual memories of all sorts of objects like faces, animals, tools, body parts, and so on. Your other senses have similar hierarchies. Your cortex has a primary auditory area called A1 and a hierarchy of auditory regions above it, and it has a primary somatosensory body sense area called S1 and a hierarchy of somatosensory regions above that. Eventually, sensory information passes into association areas, which is the name sometimes used for the regions of the cortex that receive inputs from more than one sense. For example, your cortex has areas that receive input from both vision and touch. It is thanks to association regions that you are able to be aware that the sight of a fly crawling up your arm and the tickling sensation you feel there share the same cause. Most of these areas receive highly processed input from several senses, and their functions remain unclear. I will have much to say about the cortical hierarchy later in the book.